There is one question that I wanted to ask, going back a little bit in the history, and that is the reaction in New York to the press conference given by President Truman, which seemed to open the possibility of the utilization of nuclear weapons in Korea. What was the effect of that in New York?
Well, it was a shock. Of course, I think that it couldn't be better described than Acheson does in his memoirs, the present of the creation. And but consternation in London, and the trip, rush trip by Prime Minister Attlee,
right,
and so forth. That in New York, we had the similar reaction generally around the board, and I was instructed to make certain that the delegations understood that the president had not intended to threaten or indicate the use of atomic weapons, that he had frankly tried to say that that in a war you never rule out the use of anything. Except, you know, in a sort of a general proposition that had no relation in his mind to the atomic weapon at that point, although the question was specifically addressed to the atomic weapon. It's a careless slip, I think one would say that. It was just inadvertent, and Acheson and others used it as a horrible example of why press conferences and of delicate matters are the worst institution that has ever been developed in diplomacy. But there was concern about it, but we were all reassuring. See, we didn't want to say we'd never used atomic weapons.
Right.
We never wanted to say that.
Right. This leads to another question, and that is the concern with the broadening of the war to include China or perhaps into a world war. My impression from reading the various memoirs is that from the very beginning, President Truman saw the danger of this and was determined that the war in Korea would not be expanded. I wonder, did you have specific instructions on this in New York? Were there extensive discussions with the Secretary General or with the other delegations on this subject?
Of the possibility?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, well, actually, to go back again to that message that I read into the record of this here.
Right.
The sentence which struck me, that there was a very first one, in view of the undeniably heightened danger of general war.
Right.
We should overlook no honorable possibility of bringing about a peaceful settlement in Korea. There was no question but that that the just as that said that there that many delegations, and I'm certain the United States, as that that message put down, that there was a danger of general war, because if China actually went to war against the United States, the Russians would not be far behind. That was obvious. It would be a general war. And I think those two words meant what they said. And I think that there was no doubt may sound dogmatic about what the delegations thought, but I have evidence to support that. And that evidence was the opposition we encountered. I don't know if you want to get into this, the opposition we encountered when we proposed that there be what we call additional measures against China, which was called the strategic embargo. In other words, a resolution we proposed, which I discussed at great length with all the responsible delegations, starting with the British and French, to approve a resolution which the members of the UN undertook to embargo shipment of any war material, including POL, petroleum, on lubricants, the usual war sustaining material resources or material. And there, specifically, time after time in discussions with you were represented when we were stimulating or support,
right,
was that this might drive the Chinese to general war. That we goad them, because it's a matter of strangling their ability, or at least impairing their ability, their military capability, in holding on to Korea, or carrying on their operations south of the 38th parallel for the whole. In other words, to do what the Russian mounted invasion had set out to do back in June of 1950. So that was tangible evidence of the fear of a general war. We had a considerable difficulty getting support for that. And again, it became a public knowledge that our close allies were not very happy about that. But there it was. They did adopt the...
The resolution was passed, yeah, eventually.
Yeah.
Just a final question in this connection. Which delegations would you identify as having been the most helpful, the most positive during the Korean crisis, other than the British?
Well, I say other than the British, right, because despite occasional griping, right, and admonitions, they really were 100%
right,
Canadian. Canadian.
Although the Canadians also had, I know that, again, in Mr. Acheson's memoirs, he suggests that there were two very unreliable people in New York. One was Krishna Menon, and the other was Lester Pearson. I think he suspected that the Canadians...
He and Mike Pearson were good friends, nonetheless. Well, he thought Pearson was a little woolly-headed. For one thing, he was a very pro-U.S. He and Acheson really respected each other. But they were different temperaments, totally different temperaments. And Pearson was anything but an intellectual. He was smart as a whip, but he was anything but intellectual in the Achesonian sense.
And, of course, he felt strongly that the People's Republic should be seated, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. Of course, he was bucking for Secretary General, as you know, to be, right, Secretary General. Acheson thought that was another sign of his sort of moral decline. Who would ever want to be Secretary General? So it was funny. But just one quick story,
right,
if you have a moment, because I wanted to finish up with Acheson, because he's such a wonderful fellow. I mean, I just loved him. I mentioned he had thought it was a psychiatric problem which had induced me to want to go to the UN, mission to UN. U.S. mission. So one of the things he said was nothing ever happens up there. Totally dead. I mean, it's really, this is in, I think, October or November of 1949, something like that. We had just finished our major labors on the North Atlantic Treaty. I didn't waste it until then. And he said, when he came up to the General Assembly after Korea, he got very fed up with Vyshinsky's endless tirades. So he turned around back to, I was sitting right back at him as always. He said, let's go out and relax a bit. We had somebody else take his seat, and he said, let's go to the bar. So we went to the bar at the delegates' lounge, and he said, my friend and I crave a martini, he said to the bartender. So he served, he lifted his glass up, and he said, Ernie, he said, let's drink to the activity at the UN. He was apologizing, but he told me that there wasn't anything happening up here. And Which, another story. I went over to Alexander Cadogan, was the British representative, and a very fine person. He didn't stay very long after I arrived, but I did long enough to get to know him and visit his home out in Long Island a number of times and so forth. So he was recalled. He was fed up and wanted to leave, I guess, or his term was up. So it was in some time in early 1950, as I remember. He sailed on the Queen Mary, and they had a big reception on the after deck. They were toasting and whatnot. So we were talking at the rail of Queen Mary, and I said, "I'm sorry you're leaving, Alex. This is really, really too bad to lose you. You've been such a tower of strength up here." He said, "Yep, the trouble is, Ernie, nothing ever happens here." He said, "This organization is winding down." He said, quote, "This is winding down." Within weeks after he got to London, the Korea broke. It was really very funny. That was just a personal reminiscence.